The following episode of Backstory Podcast was recorded live at the 26th Annual Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. You can listen to this episode and you can watch it on our YouTube channel. So hello and welcome to Backstory, the podcast from the Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. I'm Aaron C.Y. Collier, the Artistic Director of Real Asian. We're here with Rice Boy Sleeps writer and director Anthony Shim and lead actress Sung-Yoon Choi. We're recording live on the eve of Real Asian Film Festival, where Rice Boy Sleeps is our opening night film this year. It's been touring festivals since its premiere at the Toronto Film Festival in September, and it's been picking up awards, and it's all really well deserved for this this instant classic about a challenging relationship between a Korean Canadian single mother and her son. So we're happy to have you here and to just chat a little bit, and welcome to Real Asian.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Super excited to be here.
Yeah. Okay. So I have so many questions that I've already. I'm sure we won't get to them all, but right off the top, you know, like there was a little bit of mythology about this film. I would have to say, like, I'm good friends with Albert Shin, and he told me like some time back, he's like, there's this film, you gotta see it, So, and then he's like, I don't remember the title though, right? Like it was like a long time ago. And then, you know, more time came on and it was like, oh, Rice Boy Sleeps, what's that? Right. So like I've just right off the top, can you tell about the title of the film?
So the title of the film, it's actually based on a music album.
Okay.
By the singer of Sigur Rós.
Which is what I found when I Googled the
yes.
title.
Yes. We're like slowly overtaking that title from him. I'm just like, I'm secretly hoping that he'll just contact me one day and be like, what the hell? Like, why are you taking away my album? But I like in my writing, the way I write, I tend to pick music albums or an artist that I feel like it fits well with whatever the world that I'm building in my mind is and the characters I'm writing. And so that's one of the first things I usually do. A lot of times, kind of the music comes first, then the story. And so with this one, I was listening to the album Rice Boy Sleeps a lot, and I was having a really difficult time finding a direction, finding a focus in the story, just because I had so much sort of ideas and material that I was jotting down on the computer paper. And then I thought, you know, I'd read somewhere in a writing book that you should start with a title when you start writing a script, because it allows you to like kind of know where you're, what the trajectory of the story is. And so maybe I'll try that. And so I was listening to this album anyways, and I liked the way the title looked visually. I liked the way it sounded. So I threw it down and then I just started writing. And then over time it just stuck. I couldn't really change it because I got too married to it.
Yeah. Well, it's really evocative, right? And it, I'm sure it like leads to questions like that and opens up a pathway to a story, right? And then we see it in the early part of the film where they're calling young Donghyun Rice Boy, right? I have to say that early on in the process when we were learning about the film, how many times did we call it White Boy Sleeps? Which was, we were like, okay, folks, don't call it White Boy Sleeps. Like, just a slip of the tongue. But I'm curious, you know, this is a film a little bit about family mythology, origins, but the film itself, you know, you talked a little bit about it. What's the kind of origin story of the film itself? Like, if you were to talk about the timeline, when did this start? How long did it kind of like take you from when you were first working on this to where we are now in late 2022?
I had been thinking for a long time that if I ever got into filmmaking, that I'd want to make a film like this, more so just a film that had to do with my experiences growing up as an immigrant in the 90s. None of the specifics that are in the film now, I wasn't really thinking about that early on, but I just knew there were stories and memories I had that I thought, oh, those would make, you know, interesting scenes. Mm-hmm. And I did decide to get into filmmaking by just out of pure curiosity, really. I've always been a big fan of cinema and wanted to get into it because I started out as a theater director. Mm-hmm. And I had written this one-act play that I was developing for my with my theater company. And a few of my friends went, you know, if you just write another 30 pages, like, we could shoot it and it becomes a feature-length film. Yeah. And then now you can be a filmmaker. Uh-huh. And so it was like this, almost like, it started like an exercise. And I really just wanted to see. I'd never written anything that people acted because I wasn't a writer. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, let's give this a go and see if it works out. And if I can write, direct, and edit something that has a cohesive emotional journey that audiences can sit through. And so we did this, we made this film called Daughter. And then that gave me just enough confidence to try and tackle this story that I've been wanting to do. And because I knew, you know, it would have to take place both Canada and Korea, you know, that just obvious challenges are logistics and money.
Yeah.
Like this is not a film you can make for $100,000. Yeah. And so I felt like I could try to tackle this now. And I remember when I started telling people that I was going to make this film called Rice Boy Sleeps, or not Rice Boy Sleeps, but about this mother and son. And this was right after Daughter came out in the festivals, and it was like, it just came out, and I was like, I got to make another film. Mm. And so I got to work right away. I met with Telefilm, and the folks there told me, this is what you need to do. Just put this together, submit, and then we'll go from there. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing. I went to Mexico City for a while. And I was just like, I gotta be somewhere where I don't know anyone, mm-hmm. and I don't speak the language there.
Yeah.
And I just wrote, and I wrote really fast. And I wrote about 4 months, and then we submitted it, and then we got funding from Telefilm, and then that kind of started that was the first domino piece to fall, and then everything else came together. And so from the time I started put pen to paper to finishing the movie, I believe it was like 26 months.
Mm, wow.
Just over 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so luckily, well, I mean, I shouldn't say luckily because there's nothing lucky about COVID.
Yeah.
But the one nice thing, upside about there having been a pandemic was that I didn't have anything to do. I couldn't go outside.
Yeah.
And I was already writing. And so I thought, why not? I don't have an excuse to not write.
Yeah.
And so I was able to do so much in a short period of time. And so, I mean, I don't think my next film is going to be this quick, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, it did all move quite fast.
So when were you shooting the film? And I mean, I'm just curious about the timeline too.
So yeah, I finished writing it in 2020, and then we shot in the summer of 2021, just last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We shot in August in Vancouver, and then we went to Korea and shot all the Korea stuff in September.
Okay.
And then we just went to post, and I mean, it was all so fast. We shot the Korea, the Vancouver stuff in 15 days.
Oh, wow.
All the Korea stuff we shot in 4 days. Oh, wow. And then I cut the film in like a month and a half.
Yeah.
Because there are nothing to cut.
There's not a lot to cut. So
I'm going to ask you about that. Okay. So no, but that's interesting. Cause that's where you come in, right? Like Sunyoon. Yeah. So maybe you can talk about, I mean, you're talking about a little bit of, you writing this, and because I'm curious about the casting process and how did you get involved in the film, and what were your impressions about this? Because I've seen some of the Q&A's that you've done previously, and I understand this was the first film that you auditioned for.
Yes, yeah. It was my first audition. And to make long story short, I already knew the casting director who working with Anthony, and she always want me to work as an actor, but I was dancer, mm-hmm. So like I never take it serious. But one day she asked me again, "Here are very good projects, and I think you're a good person to do it." So at the moment, I don't know why, but yeah, maybe I can do that.
Yeah.
So I made the audition tape, and that's why I'm here.
Was there anything about the project that, I mean, did you know anything about the project going in, or was just like, this is the time for me to try this?
I knew just that this project is about the Canadian, like, single mom, the Canadian indie production and story about single mother. That was everything I knew, and then, yeah.
I mean, we'd been searching for a while.
Yeah.
And we looked all across North America. I'd spent some time in Korea doing location scouting and also trying to figure out casting.
Yeah.
Not just for this part, but also for the boys as well. And it was just really tough to find the perfect actor. Because, you know, and the main thing was finding someone who could speak the perfect amount of Korean and the perfect amount of English.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just tough to find that balance. And then also just the right look. But then also, you know, someone who embodied all of the characteristics of this person that I created.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did send that audition tape. And, you know, by that point, it was so late in the game that I had seen pretty much all there was to see, in a way, of like every iteration of that scene. And I saw hers and it was just like perfect. It was like, that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
And
was there anything about it, or it was just like a feeling that you were getting from it?
It was the way I pictured it in my mind when I wrote it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the rhythm, the tone, the pacing, everything was just on. It was just nothing was played up, nothing was missing. It had all the depth. It had the tension, it encapsulated everything that I was looking for in this character.
Mm-hmm.
And I started sharing it with everybody I knew, you know, who was working on the project or people who were helping me out, and just going like, watch this person. And everyone was like, who is this? Yeah. Like, I can't, nothing comes up when I Google this name. Like,
yeah.
And I was like, I know, like, she's a dancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were saying like, yeah, you're right, this is exactly how I pictured the character when I read it. And so, it was just a matter of making sure that all parties involved were aware that I want to cast this person because this person's perfect, but she has never acted before. But we all need to sign off on this person and just believe me that this is going to work out. And it did.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, no, your performance is great. So, I mean, how did you find that transition from, you know, a performance like, you know, lots of training in dance, but, you know, did you find that transition to acting for screen? How did you find that?
Well, still I'm finding, but we had many rehearsals together, like all together with Ethan and Noor. And also the thing is that what I learn from dancing education is that, like, it's so similar to acting, I think. So I got to know how to move my body and how to express my emotion and my thought through body. So somehow it's not a very different thing to doing acting and dancing, I think. Yeah.
And so you brought up Ethan and Noel, so, you know, the challenge of finding them. What's the story behind finding those two, who play the boy?
I had put out an ad in the Korean newspapers, basically just saying looking for actors, or just looking for Korean boys of this age range, no acting experience required. Anyone interested, just please contact us. It was the same challenges finding that actor who, because with the two boys, the younger one had to speak flawless Korean and struggle with English. The older one had to speak flawless English and have struggles speaking Korean. And so it was just, we had a hard time finding that balance to begin with. And then a friend of mine in town, Jonathan Kim, who's an actor in Toronto, I'd known from years through acting. And I reached out and just said, like, do you know any Korean kids in Toronto? They don't have to have any acting experience. And then he goes, oh, he's like, well, and Jonathan had been part of the table reads and stuff like that while I was writing. So he knew the story really well and knew the characters. He goes, you haven't met Ethan yet? Like, he's like, This kid's perfect. I just worked with him on this other project, so he sends me some pictures of Ethan, like Instagram pictures, not like he didn't like take private pictures of him. and it was the same thing. It's like I saw the pictures and I went, "That's a guy. He's our David." And then we met a few times over online or over Zoom, and he came on board. And then Noel, we also had a really difficult time, and that's like, you know, at that age, you can only direct a child that age so much. Like, you can't force them to feel things. You can't force them to work harder. Like, you need that right child. And his dad had seen the ad in the papers, and said, and his dad recently went to film school and is getting into the film industry, and so he had made these short films with his son, using his son as the actor, and so they sent us a few of these shorts, and I was going like, what are these? They're like weirdly well shot and edited and mixed,
not the usual audition.
Yeah, and like there's all these different locations. I'm like, some of this feels like it's in Korea, so I'm like, did they go out and shoot these like? Based on the script, I don't understand. But I was like, but nonetheless, this kid is a gem. He's amazing. Like, where does he live? And at this point, we had hired, we were bringing Yunon from Korea and Ethan from Toronto. We really couldn't afford to hire anyone else out of Vancouver. I was like, please, don't tell me he lives in like Singapore or something. Yeah. Yeah. And luckily, he lived in the neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, we were able to make it all work. But you know what's crazy is I didn't meet any of our leads in person prior to casting them.
Really?
And I had never seen any of them in person together either.
Really?
And so it was...
When you throw a shoe.
Were you doing like your chemistry reads over Zoom, that kind of thing? That must have been really challenging.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just like, I'm watching with the two faces next to it. I'm like, does this feel right? Like, And it was kind of crazy when we first met. You know, we all, you know, like she was in town first. We picked up Ethan at the airport, and I'm like, oh god, did I have to send one of these two home?
Yeah, wow.
But it was. I think there were no better, more suited actors for all of those roles and the three people we found. And it just, I mean, it's all meant to be.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's awesome. I mean, everybody kind of works together so well, you know. There's, you know, it's a film so much about family that you have to believe it, right? And, you know, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, editing. So I'm sure this is a question you're getting a lot, but I'm very curious about it. Your choice to shoot on film, I understand that was something decided very early on. But not only your decision to go with that creative choice, but how it affected you in the way you would shoot the film and how you would work with your cast. You know, I think it's not only that you're shooting on film, you're shooting with a lot of movement, this kind of like gliding camera. So what was part of the process of your conception of that, and then how did it affect how you worked?
Well, they all you know, all of those choices happened, you know, one informed the next and the one after that. It wasn't sort of like, not everything was premeditated. So the decision to shoot on film from the beginning was, well, I grew up wanting to be a filmmaker, loving movies because I've watched movies that were shot in film. They have a certain look, a feel, a texture that associate movies to that look. And I thought, in preparing for this film, I had decided that if this film didn't work, that I was just going to call it quits. That this just isn't for me. To make a movie, it requires a lot of investment, financial, time, energy, investment from a lot of different people. And I just...
And resources, too. I mean, not the investment of just money, but also like things. And
And it's... I just didn't want to put them to waste.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be wasting people's time and energy and money and resources. So that was kind of the feeling. I was like, you know what? This might be my final film. And so I might as well make it the way I want to make it, which mm-hmm. is, oh, I need to shoot on film. Mm-hmm. And then I started looking at all the different options, all the, from 8mm to 65. And, you know, looking at the, I looked at enough examples where I went, the 16mm film gives me the look and feel that I want, that I envisioned for this story. And there were some examples that I went, like, that's exactly it, right mm-hmm. there. Like, on that camera, on that lens, on that film stock, like, that's the look. And so I'd made that decision. And then from there, I brought on, I reached out to Chris Liu, our mm-hmm. DP. And I told him, you know, I'd written in the script that it was going to be shot on 16 and it was going to be in the aspect ratio that it is in the final product. And he said, you know, you want to shoot 4:3 on 16mm film? He's like, you got my attention, like, just off that.
Yeah.
Because Chris is a huge...
Had you worked with him before?
No. Albert Shin introduced me to Chris. Because Albert has been sort of like a big brother of mine. Like, I've learned so much from him and he's shared so much that, you know, allowed me to make this film. And because he'd read, one of the early drafts of the script. He was one of the first people to see the cut. Mm-hmm. And when I told him that I wanted to shoot on film and I was looking for a DP, he goes, you got to contact Chris Liu. Mm. And because he had just shot a short film that Albert produced, that his production, Albert's part, Igor.
Yeah, Igor. Yeah.
Igor directed this film called The Archivist. And I watched that and I went like, this looks amazing. This is the kind of feel I want. And so Chris came on board and we talked and we just kind of like, the way I described it was like, we just like, kind of like flirted over Zoom for like 3 months.
Yeah.
Like never like committing to each other, but just talking about a lot, like talking about ideas and our tastes and things and certain directions that we could go in with this film. And it was just so obvious that we're on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is just getting really long, but really like the main thing that we agreed on was, because a lot of people were asking me during the script stage, whose perspective is this story being told from?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the criticism I got was, it's not quite the mother's POV and it's not quite the son's POV. Yeah. Like, you got to commit to something.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't. I don't have to listen to you.
Yeah.
I like the perspective that it's being told from.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I brought that up to Chris and he goes, yeah, he goes, I don't think it's from either perspectives. And so we had come up with the same, the same idea separately, and which was that it's being told from this unknown entity, more so like a spirit mm-hmm. of sort. And how we described it was, what if it was the spirit of the deceased father in the mm-hmm. story, and though as though he was the one telling the story of his family, and it starts off with his narration.
Yeah,
we don't explicitly say, "I am the father of these people," but it's told from that manner, and and we thought, okay, so if that's the case, then. Well, where would the camera be? You know, every time we try to figure out like what lens and where are we shooting from and how much movement or if there is any movement and, all those reasons why we always go back to, if we were the father of this boy or the deceased lover of this woman watching this specific moment, where would we want to watch mm-hmm. from? And that informed, because now we're making decisions that are informed by emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything felt really grounded in something that felt honest at the mm-hmm. moment. And none of the movement felt forced. I mean, a couple times we can watch back then. We're like, we were off on that one. But it was, early days.
Yeah.
And try to operate from a place of just instinct and gut and feeling instead of being too intellectual about it. And then that also allowed us to come to the conclusion that there shouldn't be conventional coverage of a scene. Because if you really were the spirit of the father, if you're committing to that, it just kind of felt like You just turn your head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or you just walk, look around the corner, and
you wouldn't be like, well, hold on, and then walk over.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Or yeah, like inserts.
Yeah,
you know, we decided we weren't going to do inserts because that just does kind of take away from the feeling that we were trying to create, and so it allowed the camera to just feel almost like the camera's in the room and it's operating on its own from its own emotional place.
No, it's, I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, I think that's one of the things that gives the film such a unique quality is that perspective. And that, you know, I also think that it's really admirable, too, that that kind of visual approach is not trying to overwhelm anything. It's not doing gymnastics to, like, show off about the visuals, right? It's trying to show this perspective. And in a balanced way, I think, between the various characters. So, but then if you decide from that, that you're going to think how to shoot something from that emotional perspective. Maybe talk about an example of a scene. How would you set that up? How would you work with your cast? Like, you know, are you blocking things out and then the camera is reacting to that? Like, how can you break it down a little bit?
We do it everything at the same time. Like, when Nectar was doing blocking with directors, and then the camera team also blocking with us. Mm-hmm. So we kind of choreograph everything together. Yeah, for one scene. Yeah,
and because I do come from an acting background and a theater background, and for me, you know, what I've talked so much about in the theater days is when you have a scene that works, it works because everyone's locked in.
Mm-hmm.
On film, sometimes you have these great moments, but the camera's just on the one person, and you're watching the other person off camera going like, that's got to be on screen.
Yeah.
And because sometimes what happens too is, especially with less experienced actors, when the camera's on your face and your face only, and you know it's like close up on your face, just no matter what, you just get a little bit, something just turns up in you, and there's a little bit of tension. There's a little bit of, okay, this is when I got to bring the good stuff. While in my opinion, the person off camera is doing the best work because there's no pressure. It's easy. It's relaxed. It's loose. And it's entirely for the other person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I felt like, okay, I got to work with the actors that I have, and they don't have a lot of experience. And if I can get them clicking in, firing on all cylinders at the same time, I don't want to lose some of that. I don't have to cut away from that. I don't have to manipulate these performances. And so what if we don't cut, and if we keep it all in the moment and allow them to be messy and organic, because I also don't want them worrying about the technical parts of acting, not jumping on each other's lines or not, making an action that like is inappropriate. As long as it just act natural, do whatever feels authentic to you in the moment, and the camera will just capture it. And we're going for an overall authentic, sort of almost raw, messy look and feel to it anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we rehearsed. And, an example would be, the scene where... does this ruin anything?
It's okay. Spoilers, yeah. People. Yeah. So, you know, what? Listen to this after you watch the movie. But.
You know, like, you know, the scene when So-young tells him some bad news in the morning.
Yes.
I mean, that's a very long scene.
Yes. It's about
four and a half minutes.
Yeah.
And we just had to be really specific about where the camera's going to start, whose perspective whose point of view we're going to stick to, and then when are we going to switch, and then pick these like key points of where we frame the actor within the frame, that, you know, we position the actor within the frame. This becomes kind of like check marks throughout the scene.
Yeah.
And so we knew we were shooting in that location, and then we kind of mapped out the space in a rehearsal space, and we worked, you know, the three of us rehearsed, and then after a certain amount of rehearsals, Chris came in on the rehearsals, and we just shot on our iPhone, and we worked out some of the movement, so they were also comfortable with sort of where the camera was going to be, And then, you know, because we knew we were shooting on film, we got about 10 minutes one reel.
Yeah.
And if it's like giving ourselves like 5 minutes a take, it gives us two takes per roll. Yeah. And if we mess up halfway through, that's just, you know, we just got a bunch of, you know, like reels that are not complete. And so everybody knew there's no effing around.
Yeah.
And so that day was special. That was the day she loved.
Mm-hmm. I love that experience because like when we blocking and rehearsal together with camera team, everybody, because on a set there are only like a few people who has to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because Anthony needed a small group of staff, so everyone just sat and watched us. So it was kind of, for me, it was feel like I'm doing play on the stage.
I think we had probably like a dozen people in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And like, once again, it was just only the people that absolutely need to be in this room were there standing by, and everybody, because it's a long scene.
Yeah.
So everybody just sat in one side of the room on the ground.
And on the couch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just were... And the way the room was shaped too, it kind of did feel like it's a stage, and the audience was on one side, and everybody was just so locked in, and they knew it was complicated, they knew it was a tough scene emotionally for the actors as
There's a lot of dynamics in that scene.
So, you know, I had told Chris, I said, you know, and you know, expressed this to the rest of the team as well. I said, while we're rehearsing, you can make as many tweaks, you know, adjustments, and if you need time to just change something entirely, do it. Like, do whatever you need to do to do, you know, that makes your work shine at the end of the day. But once we start rolling, I don't care how you feel about it, we're not changing a thing. Mm-hmm. Because we can't kill the momentum.
Yeah.
And so everybody knowing that, we're just way more locked in, made sure, okay, like, make sure everything I need to do is my responsibilities are checked, and then nobody wanted to be the person that messed up this amazing scene that everyone knew I was not going to cut. It had to be all or nothing.
Yeah.
So nobody wanted to be the one that messed up a perfect take performance-wise and camera-wise because they forgot to move their Starbucks cup.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or like...
Oh my God,
you know, or they decided to walk into the room at the wrong time or flush the toilet at the wrong time.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody knew what was happening. And so it created this...
pressure, atmosphere.
Not a tension, but a focus.
Yeah.
And all the stakes were raised. And I thought it brought out some of the best... in everyone.
Well, and that scene is so loaded with stakes too, right? And so much like things that need to be conveyed from both of them, and it's such a pivotal moment, right? So I love that scene. I love that, like, going for it, you know. You mentioned the word messy, and I love that word. I don't think the film is like super messy, but I think what I love about that is it's the result of like trying things, not trying to be exacting about something. It's a little bit about a journey, but obviously you're aiming for something. You mentioned in another interview Q&A that you also felt that way about the audio as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can describe how your approach to the audio contributed to this kind of messiness.
I wanted things to sound real.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want it to sound all, you know, because of the way I wanted the picture to look, which was to feel authentic and textured and nuanced and almost as though it's, you know, I was comparing it to, you know, wanting to create the experience of watching this movie to flipping through your childhood photo album.
Because
the photos from your childhood, you know, if you're young enough or old enough where they were shot on film, they're not perfect photos.
No.
A lot of them are out of focus, or there's, you know, like
there's some guy in the background with like his shorts are weird.
Like someone's like half their face is like cut out of frame, or there's like it's washed out. Like it's, they're flawed, but they're packed with so much feeling and memory. And so that's the experience that I wanted to create visually for this film. I said, while we have that visually, the other half of the movie experience, which is sound, cannot feel pristine mm-hmm. and, you know, perfectly neatly packaged and, you know, flawless. I want it to sound real.
Yeah, Anthony always talk to the actors, don't wait for next line. Mm. You can overlapping mm-hmm. to say something.
Yeah, just so it like feels organic.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Like express yourselves. Like, you know, when there's 4, 5, 6 people in a scene, is like, you know, it you lose that authenticity when everyone's going like, don't make any sounds.
Yeah.
What the other person's saying their important line, like people almost like hold their breaths and wait. Okay, now I can act. Mm-hmm. You know, but mm-hmm. I wanted everyone to just feel alive at the same time, and I said, don't worry about the sound. And so I also hate ADR.
Yeah.
And I hate using sounds from like libraries mm-hmm. because it just feels like you're using, we wouldn't use stock footage. I mean, I refuse to use stock footage. Mm-hmm. Why would I use stock sound? Mm-hmm. It just feels like you're cheating. It just, yeah. just feels used. And so Matt Drake, our sound designer, we talked from the script stage. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about post, we're talking about sound. And I said, this is all the things I want about the sound. Like, what do we need to do on set to make the outcome, the final product, the way I want it to sound? And he goes, well, you need to hire a really great sound mixer. And he said, I got one name and one name only. And we went and got that person.
Yeah. And their name is?
His name is Nate. Uh-huh. And Nate came on board, and yes, he was amazing. And he knew the drill. Certain scenes we're not cutting, and there's 8 people talking. Mm-hmm. And so we need to laugh up everyone, and you know, and he's mixing on, you know, on the day, and it's like, I don't want to take anything away from Matt's mixing, because he did an amazing job mm-hmm. of, he made magic happen, but we like, there's not much that wasn't recorded on location mm-hmm. that's like, and I hate Foley as well, and of course there's Foley in the film because it's necessary, but yeah. like the important sounds,
yeah.
It's, you know, the sound of eating, the sound of chopsticks hitting the table when you put it down, or when it touches your lips, and you know, when people drink, like these subtle sounds, they are a part of the actor's expression.
Yeah.
It's a part of the performance. And I didn't want to replace it with, you know, manufactured sounds. Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you something. You can hear my heart beating sound. Uh-huh. When I has a Hughes fight with Ethan.
Oh.
With David. Uh-huh. So
yeah, like yeah. all of the really like longer, heavy scenes.
Yeah.
Emotional scenes. Like when the scene gets good, and as the scene progresses like throughout the take, you can hear her heart beating louder and louder. And you can actually hear it in the
surround sound. It's yeah. one of the channels, yeah. right? So
yeah, and that translates, you know, you know, everything I just said about sound, you know, that was also the case with the music mm-hmm. that we created, you know. So, like, it all, like, all those conversations were happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And it was a blast.
Yeah, yeah. I want to kind of go back to something you mentioned in the beginning. You had mentioned you had done a film before this. So this is your second feature film. You know, I'm curious some of the learnings that you took from that first one. You know, I think a lot of people get an opportunity. Sorry, not a lot of people get an opportunity to make a feature film, but the ones who do, it's probably even rarer that you get a second chance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with like Telefilm's Talent to Watch program, there's a lot of people relatively. Sorry, I keep saying a lot, but relatively some people who are getting a chance, right? But you don't see a lot of them getting a second chance. But what are some things that you took from that first film to the second film?
I mean, there are so many things. But I would say the main thing I took away from the first one was, well, my biggest regret after making the first one was, I remember thinking to myself, God, I wish I had imposed my vision stronger on everyone. Mm-hmm. In that because it was my first go at it, and I didn't grow up making short films. I didn't, you know, like I didn't have the experience that a lot of first-time filmmakers usually have with short films or music videos or commercials, whatever else their background may be. I came from a theater background, so I felt like such a, you know, amateur in a sense on a film set. Like, I mean, I've been on a lot of film sets as an actor, but as a director, I just didn't have the same kind of confidence. And so I relied on everyone a lot more. And trust, there's a difference between trusting your collaborators and opposed to relying on your collaborators, because there were times where I go, I don't think this is right, or I don't think this is the way I want it. Mm. But I just didn't feel comfortable or confident to say, no, I know what you're trying to do, but no, it's not, that's not it. We got to go this way.
Yeah.
So just kind of let a lot of things slide. And then, you know, at the end of it all, I go, like, I knew I wanted to do it this way. And I have no one to blame but myself. Mm-hmm. Nobody put a gun in my head to shoot things a certain way or prepare it a certain way or to, you know.
Yeah.
It was ultimately on me. And so with this one, I mean, if my advice would be like, make your film, if it's your first, make it like it's your last one, because mm-hmm. it likely will be. as in, don't hold anything back.
Yeah.
Be open and generous and kind and you know, understanding of the people you work with, because it is an incredible privilege to get to make a movie. But at the same time, it's your movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And this likely will be your only shot at living, you know, only chance to take a stab at, you know, fulfilling your dreams as a filmmaker. God, there's so many movies that get made every year, and it's so hard to stand out. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to get recognized. And the only shot I think one has when you're starting out is be bold. Trust, you know, really trust your gut, and don't hold anything back.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then if you fail, I mean, you're most like most films, like quote unquote fail anyways, like just because it's so hard to make a movie that works. And so if you're gonna fail, you might as well fail like gloriously, you know,
on your terms.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
Not because you're going like, oh, it's because that other person did all the things I didn't want them to do.
Yeah.
It's like, well, do it on your own terms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, I mentioned in the beginning that, you know, you've been winning a lot of awards and fantastic, like, and well-deserved too. And maybe this goes to how you think about both your first and this film. It's like, how do you measure, you know, because we're talking about like, you know, how do you measure that success? Because what are the metrics that something is a failure is a lot of external metrics, right? So how do you measure success of your creative process? You know, like has some of the recognition changed how you've seen it? Has some of the reception changed how you see it?
The way I determine something that I've done is a success or not, I think really has to do with what my intention was and whether that intention landed on the audiences in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I wanted to affect audiences a certain way, one way, and then they come out of it going, just completely missing the mark and just feeling something else, and especially if it's not a positive one,
yeah,
and I really didn't do my job right. I was off the mark somewhere along the way, because, you know, like I've done a lot of theater, most of the theater I've done, very few people watched. And, you know, a couple of the projects that I'm the most proud of, very few people watched it. That would not, you know, it lost money, like, mm-hmm. didn't win any awards. It didn't like create new opportunities for me, but I am as proud of those as anything else I've ever done creatively. Mm-hmm. And so this, I think it's a huge success because I had a vision, I surrounded myself with really great people who were like-minded and were as passionate as I was. Not as passionate, I mean, you can't expect anyone to be as passionate as your own movie, but who had the right kind of passion mm-hmm. for the project. And we collaborated in a really joyous way, and we executed our vision. Mm-hmm. And so everything and anything beyond that, it's just gravy. Because mm-hmm. like in our eyes, we won already, like before this came out.
Yeah.
And now this is all just very, you know, it's validating, and it, you know, makes us feel like, gives us that extra bit of confidence now to, let's try it again. Let's
yeah.
double down on this thing.
Yeah.
Also, all these awards, you know, it's amazing. I'm so grateful for them, for the recognition and the reception. But it doesn't change anything when I sit down in front of my computer to write the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
The script doesn't get
easier. Back in line, right?
Yeah. Those words, those lines don't, you know, they don't come out, you know, easier. I don't come up with more, like coming up with story ideas doesn't become any easier than before.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm just trying to take it as all it comes. But
yeah. I'm curious, you know, mentioned that the film has played some really, you know, prestigious big film festivals, premiered at TIFF, played in Busan. I'm curious, you know, we were talking a little bit about reception. What was some of the reception, the reaction? What was it like to play it at TIFF versus Busan and some other festivals? I mean, we're doing this before we're showing it at Real Asian, so we don't know about tomorrow, but I'm
think
curious.
Tomorrow's gonna go okay.
I think so.
I don't
too.
Think we're gonna get booed or anything.
Passing out tomatoes. Yeah. No. But what was it like to show it? I mean, I'm particularly curious about Busan.
Busan, we were so nervous because we didn't know how Korean will take this story, because as I know, Korea is not an immigrant country. So in my opinion, I thought they might not like it.
Mm.
They might not understand as like here. But so we were in Busan, and audience in the festival, they were so quiet and silence.
Zero laughs.
Oh no. No laughs for Simon at all.
we got our first chuckle at like hour and 30 minutes in.
Yeah, so we both thought, oh, it's bad.
Mm.
Yeah, we failed. Like,
yeah.
But later it turns out Korean really loved this film. They just took it very seriously. So that's why they couldn't laugh, or they couldn't even like, what is that?
Applaud.
Yeah.
Because what's really interesting about the North American audiences compared to the Korean audiences was that in North America, people really reacted to the immigrant story.
Yeah.
You know, being an outsider, being, you know, overcoming societal, racial challenges. And but also understood a lot of the humor in it too. And then in Korea, because like you said, they don't have firsthand experience with being immigrants, or even know too many immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
They lost some of those beats in the film, but instead we're seeing the story as a seeing the mother son part of the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just all about that. And it was about that journey. And so, it, you know, some of the humor got lost, but they felt, I don't want to say deeper, because I don't want to compare what audiences are experiencing, but it appeared as though it was more of a linear emotional journey for the audiences there.
Mm.
And were deeply moved by that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, I wouldn't say like, you know, we're not going like, oh, that reaction is better than the other.
Yeah,
just like,
yeah,
we'll take it all. But it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Surprised.
That people took it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And audiences, I found that the most passionate audiences in Korea, a lot of them were younger women.
Mm.
And I think they just really, really admired and loved the character of Soyeon, mm-hmm. which was really cool. We'll continue to see what the reactions in Korea is like as we do the theatrical.
Yeah, so interested to see. I mean, you're going to be taking it on the road to some other very different audiences very soon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Morocco, that's going to be our first non-English speaking or non-Korean speaking. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we've been a little bit like in our comfort zone.
Yeah.
Between those two territories. But, you know, Morocco, that's a different world. So...
in Saudi Arabia too.
Yeah, I don't know if we're allowed to talk about that yet.
Yet?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cut. Okay.
I think we're gonna wrap this part soon, but I want to ask a kind of a bigger question maybe, and I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but I think, you know, this is such a personal story to you. I understand. And I think in this kind of North American context that we're making this film in, do you think that conversation around personal stories and lived experience, is that a potential trap for BIPOC creators? In that, does that limit our storytelling to explicitly personal narratives?
I'm not sure.
This is a larger kind of like cultural conversation, I think, right? And, you know, the experience of making a personal film versus like, what can you do later, right? What else can you do? There's a lot of pressure, I think, for BIPOC creators to speak from this term lived experience, right? But what lays beyond that for these creators, right?
I don't know. I mean I found that if it is a trap, I fell into it, and I got,
it's not a bad one. I mean, right. You know, we create to discover things, right? Whether it's about ourselves, about the world.
But would you say it's a BIPOC thing?
I think there is more pressure to do it, and almost potentially more funding in it, right?
No, well, I see what you're getting at. Because I mean, Truffaut's first film was based on his childhood, right? Taika Waititi's first film was based on his own childhood. So you know, filmmakers making their first or second films about their, you know, childhood is not a new thing, but I do think that if you're talking specifically about BIPOC filmmakers of the current time, yes, there is a pressure. There is a pressure that it feels like we as you know, immigrants or people of color, you have to tell your story because no one else has done that in the past. But I also know that a lot of BIPOC filmmakers that I know want to move beyond that and want to tell stories about other ethnicities and other periods of time. I don't know. It's so hard to talk about this. Is there pressure? Probably. Is there more fun? Is there a better chance for me to get funding? You know, 3 years ago, was there a better chance of me getting funding for Rice Boy Sleeps than if I were to make a story about, let's say, you know, a working class family in you know, the suburbs of BC that's white and, you know, are dealing with different societal issues? I don't know.
And to be transparent, like, if you made that film, we probably wouldn't have programmed it. You know what I mean? Like,
I did make a film.
Yeah.
My first film was about a white family.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it wasn't as successful because it was about a white family. I mean, I think story-wise and quality of filmmaking, I think they are different. And I think Rice Boy Sleeps does, you know, I think the film can you know, stand on its own 2 feet as like just a well-made movie beyond the fact that it's about Korean immigrants and... Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Let's put it this way. There are advantages. It is easier to stand out as a filmmaker if you get really personal about your own identity and your uniqueness, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not sure if that's a BIPOC thing, because you say the same thing about if you grew up in the slums of somewhere and it has nothing to do with nationality or ethnicity, or if you had like a really like crazy job as a kid and you wanted to make a movie about that job, like I don't know. There's no answers.
Yeah. There's no right answer. I'm just, it's something that I think I've been thinking about, just as in the larger kind of creative space, especially in Canada, North America.
I think what's important is whether a young filmmaker wants to make a film about their own childhood or their own lived experience. What I try to tell myself when I think about writing or making another film is I have to feel like there's no one else in the world that can tell this story better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is no, then I got to pass on. I can't do that. I got to let that other person who is more qualified to tell that story tell it. And I think in that sense, sometimes the ethnic identity might play a part in that. Because, if I was to tell a story about potato farmers of the 1800s, which is a story I wanted to tell at one point, there's probably people who have a more, personal experience with that story.
Mm-hmm.
And they might be a better fit. And so, I don't know. I think that's important. God, I need more water. Just one second.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back with some quick fire questions and eat some snacks. Trying something new where it's a little segment we're calling Come Eat With Me. So we're having our festival guests, and you are the first festival guests that we've had on Backstory for this year, and the first ones that you'll be eating with us together.
Potentially humiliating yourself.
Yes, and please don't spill food on your clothes. I'm very sorry.
This is my first mukbang.
So we have, in honor of Rice Boy Sleeps, we have rice rolls, Trung Fun, and so we have three different kinds. We have the my old favorite as a kid, the dried shrimp, and green onions, and then we have the surf and turf beef and shrimp, and then the kind of the double carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. Of the rice roll wrapped around a donut.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah,
and I appreciate that you didn't serve like kimbap. I mean, a little on the nose.
Yeah. Well, so part of it is,
make sure you can, make your sounds.
The ASMR.
Yeah. No, I don't want to make that dirty sound. Like.
I know. That's funny. So, we have a summer program and where first time filmmakers make their first film, and one of the cohorts, they were. They learn how to do sound, and then they're getting the boom in there. Like, we're not recording yet, but they're just like listening to it, and they're like, yeah, ASMR that shit.
It makes me really uncomfortable.
I think it's a little bit funny, but
For one of these segments, you should just have people eating really hot ramen.
Yeah, well,
it'd be so loud and gross.
Oh. Get a upset stomach afterwards. Yeah. But so one of the things is like, the normal, not normal, but the my co-host on this podcast, Kelly Louie, who's our shorts programmer, this is actually one of our questions, and maybe we can, maybe we'll leave it to the end. But she and I dispute the supremacy of rice versus noodles. And so I thought, as a gesture to open up this festival, these are kind of rice and noodles.
This
together.
Is so good.
So, yeah.
This is so good.
So I have some quick fire questions, and we'll keep eating. Talk with your mouth full. I'm going to talk with my mouth full.
I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good.
Nothing on your clothes?
Yeah.
Okay. We're recording live, folks.
Yeah.
We're recording live.
That was typical Anthony's moment.
I'm too excited right now. Sorry, what were we talking about?
We're going to shoot you some quick fire questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
And actually, let me go. I'm going to cut to the chase and get to the most controversial one. This is the one that Kelly and I always argue about. So you can only pick one.
Yeah.
One carbohydrate. So.
Oh, we've talked about this before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rice, noodles, bread. So it can also not just like sliced bread, but you know, like a tortilla or something like that, or potatoes. You can only choose one.
This is the thing that makes the difference for me. When you say noodles,
mm-hmm.
does that include pasta?
Absolutely.
Anything that's in the shape of like long and thin?
It's kind of like something that is formed from a dough and I guess boiled?
So then like even lasagna counts?
Well, yeah, for sure.
Well, then it's noodles for me.
Hmm.
Okay.
Noodles.
Noodles for you too?
Yeah.
Because really?
There are rice noodles.
Okay, but see, yeah. Okay. So that's also, my thing is rice, because I also say, well, because then I can make rice noodles. Mm. But Kelly's not here to dispute that. And she's like, no, you can't do that.
Well, no, because then you can go into like anything, right? Yeah, made from rice flour. Then you can go into desserts. There's so much that's made from rice.
Well, we've had a previous guest. Say bread, because he was trying to make the case that cake is a bread.
Sure. So
well, you're no, but then
I could do without cake.
Well, this guest couldn't. So
right. If that's what does it for the person, then okay, that's fine. But I mean, for me, it's. I mean, I love rice. I mean, I mean, I love rice, but I love noodles too much. It's.
Mm. Okay, what's your favorite noodle dish then?
If I had to eat only one type of noodle for the rest of my life, mm-hmm. I'd eat pho for the rest of my life.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm.
Me too.
Really? Yeah. Okay. You got big on pho. Mm. All right.
I mean, and I love ramen, but it's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It can be heavy or spicy.
No, I just... Yeah. Or bunchaka.
Like that's in the pho category,
okay.
Right?
It's pho family.
Like, yeah. Vietnamese, you know, noodles and broth. That's like... It's light, yeah.
Okay.
It's delicious, and I never get sick of it.
No.
Okay, you know, you taking this film, so we got some quick fire questions.
Okay.
You've had a lot of Q&As, I'm sure. What's a question that nobody's asked you yet that you'd actually like people to know about the film?
Actually, I had read your email, and I found very nice, good question. That you were asking me about, I don't know exact the sentence, but I just will say my answer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I first read this script, I was thinking, oh, this is really well written story and script. So that's why I wanted to get this job. And then after finished and making this film together, and when we started to no even before when we shooting, I slowly realized that this is pretty not this is quite important than I thought.
Mm.
To portray themselves,
mm-hmm.
in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never thought like me as an like Asian, not of course I'm Asian, but I live in Seoul and
yeah.
Korea, so I never make myself like I didn't have any distance
between myself and to my society, to my country. But people in here, they have that kind of like distance, mm-hmm. and they always thinking about what is that, and they always questioning about that distance. And so during shooting this film, I realized that how important it is to make Asian like story, like our story by ourselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just got to know that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, thanks for that. No, I, you know, we were jumping around in a lot of the questions, so thank you for sharing that story. I think, you know, it's something that's hard for us to reconcile, I think, in a lot of ways here. In mm-hmm. it's kind of like a lifelong thing in each of us, like in our experiences. So
So I'm very glad that I got to know these things as a Korean and as an Asian. Yeah. This is what I want to say.
Okay. No, that's great. Thank you. Is there any, how about you, Anthony? Is there any questions that you know, you kind of like go out on the road and you kind of get a lot of similar questions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no one asks about the Korean actors.
Oh, yeah.
Like the actors like that are right. in the Korea right. portion of the film,
right?
Because they're amazing. Mm-hmm. They're some of my favorite parts of the whole movie. You know, and those are just. I mean, we talked earlier about how, you know, I think we have found the perfect people for our leads, but I mean that's across the board. Like even all of our supporting actors in Vancouver were just incredible, but the actors in Korea, they're magic.
I love the Harabuji. He's like, he's great.
He's he's
that
he's
shot
amazing
where,
man.
He, where he first comes in.
Yeah,
and you're talking about like he's not talking, but it's all his reaction. Yeah. Like it's just a beautiful moment, right? And that's his intro, right? He's this like really gentle presence, you know.
And Yoon is related to him.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but his name is Choi Jong-yul.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea, we share same like middle name.
You don't know this? You know this? You're married to a Korean person.
The same middle name.
Yeah, middle name. Each family.
Oh yeah. Of course.
So he has the same middle name as my grandpa. So I was wondering, as like, is he like coming from same family like me? So I was asking to him. So are you come from Gangneung? So.
And were you serious, or were you kind of just like, oh, he's probably not, but just guessing?
No, I was quite
Oh, you
serious.
Were.
Yeah. Mm. So, are you Gangneung Choi? Are you from Gangneung? Mm. So he answered yes. So wow, like we are relatives. So we didn't know because it's,
Wow.
So I found my actual family through this project. Yeah.
Just like the movie, right? Yeah. That's great. That's great. And then who plays the harmony and the uncle?
Grandma is. She's been around for so many years. If you look at her IMDb, you're like, oh my gosh, she was in that movie?
Yeah.
Like, class. I mean, both of them. The grandpa, too. Like, grandpa was in Memories of Murder, which is, I think, one of the greatest Korean films ever made. And they've over the years, they've been in, like, so many iconic films. And we just got lucky that they agreed to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. And
the uncle.
Yeah, and then the uncle. He was a theater actor for a long time, and just recently started getting into film. And I mean, we had good actors with really great auditions, but he, at the end of his audition, just spoke for about 5, 6, 7 minutes in front of the camera about his impressions of the script, of the story, and he talked about his own personal experiences and relationship with his parents and how it relates to the character. And it was so personal and it was so open and generous that I went, oh my god, why is he telling us all this? But like, thank you for it, like, because it's really touching.
And that just, that totally sold me on it. And then we had our audition, and yeah, it was like, I mean, he's become like a dear friend to us now. Like, we're like, we're all actually just like family.
Yeah.
Like a genuine love for these people. And he's, yeah, I think he's like, he, I'm like, why are you not a movie star? Like, why are you not famous? You're so good.
Yeah.
And because they're all him and the grandpa, because the grandpa's like a legendary theater actor, because they all come from the theater background. That opening scene in Korea, I mean, I put a cut in there just because we only had three takes of that scene.
Yeah.
And it's like a 7 minute long scene.
Yeah.
There was a camera, like camera move.
Yeah.
Thing that I couldn't get around. And so I ended up having to put one cut in there.
Yeah. Where you kind of, you're panning over when he comes in. Right. Yeah.
And that was, I was like, oh, I have to do this, unfortunately. But it does feel like a play in just the way, like, all the characters kind of entering the stage and leaving, and and it's an, it's like this ensemble piece where everybody needs to know when to step in, and it's a big dance. And for him and them, they're like, "Oh, this is like, this is our jam. This is what we do."
Yeah.
You mean we don't have to do all this coverage? Great, we're all in it at the same time, connected. Like we're working as a team, and so I mean. They pulled it off amazingly because I think they're so comfortable in that style of working.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, you heard it here first. what is a film or an artwork, doesn't have to just be a film, that changed your life?
I answer this. I've answered this before. I did a whole podcast on this, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a film called Peppermint Candy by Lee Chang-dong.
Mm-hmm.
It was his second film. Have you seen it?
No. You heard it here first.
You haven't seen Peppermint Candy? This is the film that I like. If you like Korean films, if you like Lee Chang-dong films, this is the one to watch. Like, that movie changed my life.
Mm.
Not only as a filmmaker, but also just as a person, as a young person. The film actually came out in 99. Part of the reason why I set Rice Boy Sleeps in 99 is because of that movie.
Oh.
So it's it covers multiple decades in that film, and it touches on really, it's kind of like a Forrest Gump-ish type thing where they touch on certain historically important moments of the country. And I mean, I'm not spoiling anything. The film opens with a man standing on a train, on train tracks, as a train's approaching.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's the poster. It's, I'm not ruining anything.
Yeah.
It's the first time that I'd ever been introduced to the concept of suicide.
Mm.
That one person could be in so much pain and turmoil that they would rather take their own life.
Mm-hmm.
And that just took my brain, just shook it all up and went like, oh, life is not so pretty and peachy as I thought it was as a kid.
Yeah.
And it exposes and explores the world of Korea in a way that I'd never seen it before, never thought about it. Some of the problems, some of the societal problems, some of the, political problems, some of the problems that people have with one another, the workplace, the way how fast the country grew, and it just expresses emotions that are so uncomfortable to watch, and that are so raw, so intense, but so human.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of this was a must watch, like a prerequisite of coming on board for Rice Boy Sleeps. Because I needed people to see, like, these are the, this is sort of the, like, how far we can go. Like, these are the notes that we can hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives people an insight into Korean history, Korean culture, Korean, personalities. So, because it's like, well, this character that moved from Korea to Vancouver,
came from that world. So mm-hmm. here's a really, really great examples of a reference that people can have.
Yeah.
Oh man, you gotta watch it. I want to curate like a collection of Korean films that I want to show in mm-hmm. Vancouver. And that would be that would be the film I start with.
Yeah. Okay.
You can be a guest programmer next year.
I want to.
How about you, Yoon?
Well, not really. I don't think I have like one film that changed my life.
No, but you talked about a dancer that you said.
Yeah, it can be another yeah. art form too.
Ah, okay. Like, there are one big company named Losas Dance Losas mm-hmm. in Belgium, and that company made by Anna Teresa, the Kiss maker, uh-huh. and she is kind of pioneer of minimal dance mm. in New York, mm. and yeah, she is so chic, and so like. I always wanted to be like her as a dancer and as a choreographer, uh-huh. and all the costume like made by Dress Van Noten is kind of like big designer in Europe, and everything she produce in with her company is perfectly. Like my taste, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I wanted to be a member of that company, but now I'm here. Yeah.
Can I ask both of you, like, just real quick, like, was there, how old were you when you were watching these things, or when it kind of like? Because my thing is like, I think there's the answer to this question is usually like some very like just a formative point, like. There's only a certain set amount of years.
I was 13.
You're 13.
And no 13-year-old should be watching a movie like that. No. But it was because at that time, in Koreatown, this is so illegal now that I think about it, but the grocery store used to rent out these blank VHS tapes where they just recorded Korean movies and,
oh, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
TV shows. And you'd go and you rent them. And because there's no like movie case... There's no poster. There's no credits. It's just a blank tape with a sticker with the Sharpie written in. It's just, you know, whatever the show or the movie is.
Yeah.
And so we were getting like all these great Korean films that were festival hits. You know, so like I was being exposed to Park Chan-wook, Bong Joon-ho, like Kim Ki-duk, and Lee Sang-dong. All of their body of work, like as they were coming mm-hmm. during that time, because you also couldn't see them anywhere else except like VIF.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because I'm, you know, 12, 13, 14, I'm not
going to VIF. No.
VIF. Yeah. I'm just seeing whatever my parents rent, and we rented everything. And so, you know, weekend night, parents go like, oh, this is a new movie from Korea that's apparently kind of famous or did really well at this festival. I don't even know if there's that much thought behind it. It's just a movie. It's a Korean movie to watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pop it in. Oh my god, like what?
Yeah. Even the title sounds very sweet.
Peppermint Candy. Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, my parents probably thought like, oh, sweet little like rom-com.
Yeah,
come on, kids, you know. And it's heavy, but also my parents were cool. They weren't the type of people that was like, you gotta watch Disney movies only because you're a child. It was no, like you watch whatever you feel comfortable watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they did like, actually, I don't know. They let me watch this film called Bad Guy by Kim Ki-duk, which is about the red light district in Korea. And that's hardcore. And I was like, once again, I was like 13 or 14. But they let me watch those movies and they were so informative. And I think that kind of like shaped the actor that I was too at a young age. Like, it was like pretty intense.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm like, that's the stuff I grew up watching.
Yeah. So. How about you? When did you first experience that
like,
dancer?
I started, my dance background education started with the ballet. Like, mm-hmm. I studied, like, I got trained crazy hard classic education.
So, like, from age of five till I went to university, and I started to watch YouTube when I was 21, and I found Anna Teresa is over there in Belgium. So I was, oh, wow, I need to go to school because she found the dance school in Belgium. But I got to know that that school only accepts a student under age 19. So I was feeling like, this is so unfair. I'm from Korea. I didn't have no information about it. So I was like, I felt so sad.
But it still changed your life though, in terms of like what that form could be, right? Yeah, and it sounds like for both of you.
Because classic ballet has such a strong like classic form. So for me, wow, dance could be like this. Like this minimal. So this shape of movements with this music. So was kind of like changed my life.
I just looked at the clock, so I don't want to keep you too long because I know you have lots of things to do. So two more questions. It's the flip side of that last question. What's like a guilty pleasure, something that you are ashamed to say you like?
Oh my God, you're gonna make me.
It's okay to say it here. Safe space.
Movie?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a movie. It could be a TV show, Love is Blind or whatever.
I recently made her watch it with me. I hadn't watched it in a while. But my guilty pleasure movie is City of Angels.
Okay. That's the Nicolas Cage?
Yeah, Meg Ryan.
Okay, yeah.
That very famous song by the Google Dolls. Yes. I don't know why, but when I was younger, I loved that movie. And it was like my go-to, like comfort movie.
Yeah.
And so we watched it recently. And I was like, it's not as good as I remember. But it still is nice. I still like watching it. Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I don't listen BTS or K-pop nowadays, but I still used to listen the first generation of K-pop singer.
Okay.
Yeah, so that could be my guilty pleasure.
Who's like your number one?
G.O.D.
Uh-huh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Any song that you like in particular?
Like everything from them. Okay,
the whole catalog.
Yeah. Yeah, because their song sounds like so gospel somehow, so make me so like calm and like, I don't know.
If it's music, that's like, it's way more embarrassing stuff. I actually did this while we were driving to set once.
Yeah.
And it was Yoon and Chris, my DP, and you know, my EP, and someone else. And I go, what's your guilty pleasure music?
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, I don't know. I don't know if I really have a guilty pleasure music. I like all, you know, all my music's pretty cool kind of thing at first. And then I first admitted mine.
Yeah.
And then I was like, let's hear it. And I was like, oh man, these are like really bad. But to each their own. Like, because mine is, you know, like, I don't think mine's bad. I think it's great, but.
What is it?
I'll
tell you some of mine.
What's yours?
Okay. So I have this thing where I watch a lot of YouTube videos, like the music video, and sometimes I don't get what the video is. But there's this trend of like, there's people who will write in the comments and they will explain what happened in the music video. And then there's this other trend where people like just pour all these emotions out and they say, this song reminds me of when my husband and I separated and I was so lost. And now we're back together. And it was like, that was the comment on like, It's All Coming Back to Me, Celine Dion. I'm not a huge Celine Dion fan, but just like, man, some of those cheeseball music, Mariah Carey, love it.
Yeah.
Smashing Pumpkins, like.
That's not a guilty pleasure.
No, I said that the other day, and yeah. I feel it's guilty because it's like, it's so cheeseball.
I listen to Smashing Pumpkins all the time.
Well, you know,
like for nostalgia's sake.
For nostalgia's sake, it's so cheeseball. But I, If it's on, I'm listening to
yeah.
it. Yeah. I'm all in. I mean,
Celine Dion is, yeah, that's guilty. Yeah. That's guilty.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Every once in a while. Like, every once in a while. Not yeah. like, it's not like once a month. Maybe like once, like, every year. I like to listen to Norah Jones.
The first album?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
So I think it's a great album. And I think Norah Jones is awesome.
It's a good album. It's a yeah. good album. I will say, like, there was a time we were, some friends and I were talking about, like, the ultimate buzzkill karaoke song.
Yeah.
It's like Norah Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Like, don't put that on. Okay. Well, we're learning things here. We're learning things.
Oh, man. This is destroying my image as a serious filmmaker.
We all have this. We all have this. We contain multitudes. You know, this is the last question. It's one that I kind of don't always like asking because, you know, you've worked so hard to get to this point. But kind of like, what's next for you? You know, like, you've worked so hard to get to this point. It's kind of like, this is what you're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But kind of like, what's next, both in the kind of like in the immediate term and then for you personally, like kind of looking outward.
I mean, it's interesting. I do always try to write from a place of truth and just whatever's going on in me. And I'm not the only person. I've heard a lot of directors and filmmakers say that, you know, I think it was like David Fincher or someone who's like, it's pretty hard to hide what's going, you know, what's on your mind when you make a movie.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of knows that's what's going on. And so I, before Rice Bush Sleeps came out, before it premiered at TIFF, I had a few months where I was just kind of waiting to see what would happen. And I started writing at that time. I was writing something that I felt like if nothing came out of this experience, I could just, you know, I could, it was a small enough budget, I could probably raise it pretty quickly and just get my gang together and then off we make it in Vancouver. And at that time it was relevant to what was going on for me. And then this last month or two, it just doesn't resonate the same way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like I'm a different person. I've learned a lot about the industry. I've learned a lot about movies as a whole. And, I feel drawn to telling different stories now. And so there is something that's possibly going to be my next film.
Yeah.
But I want to be making films. I want to continue to tell stories that, I mean, I don't even want to say like stories about Asian people. I want to tell stories that I can be really passionate about. But once again, stories that I feel like I am the best person to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
And there's conversations. There's been conversations about possibly like doing TV as well, which I'm definitely open to, as long as it fits that criteria for me. I have the same feeling as before of like, you learn so much making a film that I now go like, I want to do this again, just knowing what I know now, because I feel like if I did Rice Boy Sleeps all over again, honestly, I don't know if it'd be a better movie. It would be a different movie, but nonetheless, I feel like I have this more information I want to apply into making another movie. So yeah. I'm eager to get back to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you?
I think Rice Boy Sleeps opens other door in my life. So I want to keep opening this door,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I don't want to stick with this only one door. I want to keep dancing,
mm-hmm.
and I also try to be open myself to another opportunity in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I always keep saying that to my friends, like half serious, half joking. My job is Seungyun Choi,
mm-hmm.
and I'm Seungyun doing many things. So I'm not an actor, I'm not a dancer, but I can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Mm. Well, thank you so much for both being here for Backstory Podcast from Real Asian. That's all the time we have. Again, yeah, thanks so much. I'm the host, Aram C.Y. Collier. We have Joseph Chung live mixing for us. And I'll record a bumper later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Backstory Podcast from the Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival. Please like and subscribe and give us a 5-star review on your favorite platform. You can watch these episodes on Real Asian's YouTube channel too. And we love hearing from you, so write to us at backstory@realasian.com. For more information about us, we're @realasian or go to realasian.com.